If you're suffering from hearing loss, stay tuned for a special offer from the makers of Listen Clear, a revolutionary hearing aid breakthrough designed by top audio engineers to fit your ear almost invisibly. Right now, you can try Listen Clear hearing aids absolutely free for 45 days. You can also qualify for free shipping and free batteries for life. Listen Clear hearing aids are so lightweight and comfortable, you can wear them all day long. They're practically invisible, too, so others won't even notice you're wearing them. And the best part is, you'll be able to hear almost everything, everywhere. So do something about your hearing loss. Call Listen Clear now to get started with your 45-day risk-free hearing aid trial. This special offer won't be available for long, so call Listen Clear now.
800-716-4650. 800-716-4650. 800-716-4650. We're here 24 hours a day to help. That's 800-716-4650.
From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, nationally syndicated across the country on the Biz Talk Radio Network and coming to you from our flagship stations, Yale Radio WYBC and 1490 AM WGCH Greenwich. All talk and all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business along with the business of politics and sports. The quiet leadership of President George H.W. Bush and the inside story of how he presided over the end of the Cold War, a time when the world seemed new. That's tonight on Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Jeffrey Engel is the founding director of the Center for the Presidential History at Southern Methodist University, where my nephew recently graduated. He was educated at Cornell, Oxford, where my dad graduated, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where my other nephew graduated, and Yale, where this show started. He has authored or edited 10 books on American foreign policy, including The Fall of the Berlin Wall, The Revolutionary Legacy of 1989, and The China Diary of George H.W. Bush, The Making of a Global President. And this book, just out, When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the End of the Cold War. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, it's very good to talk to you.
So I see this guy as a really unsung one-term president, a real class act. His son got two terms, but I think he was a better president. You're not going to admit that, right?
Actually, no, I would have no problem saying that whatsoever. I think that George H.W. Bush, now that we know from everything that he did, from the opening of the diplomatic record and the classified records around the world, really needs to be reassessed and looked at as a president who guided the United States through one of the most dangerous periods in all of global history and did so with a tremendous amount of restraint and grace.
How's his health?
You know, not great, but, you know, anybody who's in their mid-90s, I think, is more thankful than anything else.
Does he feel, or do you know if he feels vindicated at all? I mean, his Iraq war, you know, in retrospect, looks like it was, you know, a coalition. It was strategically limited goals versus what happened with his son's version of the Iraq war.
You know, I'm always hesitant to put any words into the president's mouth.
Okay.
But the vindication is a very interesting word, because my experience in interviewing the president and in interviewing all of his senior foreign policy officials in particular is that they didn't ever feel a need to be vindicated because they never felt they were wrong in the first place, which is to say they understood just how complex the situations they faced were, including the end of the Iraq war, and that once people really began to appreciate what they did, that is, once the record became open, they would have the world would basically appreciate more what they did. And I think that that's actually proven to be true, especially if you think about Iraq. In fact, James Baker, who was Bush's Secretary of State, of course, used to say that, you know, people used to ask him all the time why it was that we didn't go all the way to Baghdad, why it was we didn't remove Saddam Hussein. And they said, you know, around 2006, people stopped asking. yeah, exactly, because all the problems that were subsequently faced by America were, of course, readily apparent to the group in 91.
Character, obviously, was a core of George H.W. Bush. Would he think that the standards have gone way down? And I'm not just talking about Trump, who's obvious, but even, you know, going back to Bill Clinton. Does character not matter as much anymore? And also, does being prepared not matter anymore for the office?
Well, that's a place where I feel a little bit more comfortable putting words in the president's mouth, because I know what he thinks on this issue, which is that, yes, character is really critical. Character is really the defining aspect of a person's ability to operate in the office. I mean, one of the things about the presidency that is really like real life, but is magnified a million times, is that we don't know what's going to happen next, and we don't know what crisis and what problem and what quandary is going to arise. And there is, in fact, no preparation for that, though I'll say more about preparation in a moment. There's no preparation, which means that character is really revealed in the Oval Office in many ways, that you are only going to do what you are as a person in those crises, and therefore you better have a good character. You also better be prepared, as Bush would say. In fact, Bush was arguably the single best prepared person to ever take over the Oval Office. He had been an ambassador for the United States twice. He had been a congressman. He'd been head of a national party. He'd been director of the CIA. He had been, of course, vice president for 8 years before that. And so he really, more than anyone else, was prepared for the White House and still found the problems really revealing of his own character and stressful in words that he never could have imagined.
You know, I compare him to Al Gore in one way, which is that Bush is apparently a very engaging and charismatic guy behind the scenes, but that essential personality, he wouldn't reveal it to the public. And Gore had that problem, too. Do you agree with that?
You know, I would. In fact, one of the things I write in the book, and after studying Bush for almost 20 years now, is I like to say words were not his friends. That, you know, he was never comfortable using soaring rhetoric, and especially, of course, coming in the wake of Ronald Reagan, who was clearly one of the greatest orators we've ever had as a president. Bush was never comfortable letting the world in that way, and never comfortable trying to show his real face to the world. One of the problems that he faced throughout his administration, though I argue it's actually one of the best things he did throughout his administration, was essentially keep his mouth shut and essentially not say and not explain the complexities of what he was thinking and what was going on, because he knew that complex diplomatic negotiations in particular really needed to happen without public scrutiny, really needed to happen quietly. You need to give foreign leaders the time and the space to create the political environment they need in order to make deals with you. And so therefore, time and again, the press and the public came away with the impression that Bush was either not interested or not doing anything to major public crises, when we now know he actually was doing an incredible amount, just doing it quietly.
You talk about him practicing Hippocratic diplomacy. What do you mean by that?
Well, of course, referring to the Hippocratic Oath, you know, first do no harm, that doctors are instructed. And that was basically Bush's approach to foreign policy. Remember, he came into office in 1989 at a time when everything seemed to be going America's way, quite frankly. The world was turning in a democratic fashion. The Cold War seemed to be transforming and transforming towards democracy. And we were incredibly popular, we, the United States, around the world as well. And so therefore, from Bush's perspective, these things were inevitable. He believed in democracy. He believed in freedom. He believed in the power of markets, and genuinely believed that if we are going in the right direction, the key to being a successful policymaker is to keep going in the right direction. That is to say, if you don't know how to handle a crisis, best not to do anything, because you're moving in the right way, and therefore you're more likely to crash by trying to steer than you are just simply to get through the bumps.
Interesting. Another thing that really sticks out to me, particularly what's going on currently, is the management of a foreign policy team, how close they were. And I'm talking Jim Baker, Scowcroft, Cheney. They really worked as a team.
Yeah, this group had known each other for many, many years. They had all worked together in one form or fashion under President Gerald Ford in the 1970s. And, of course, Jim Baker and George Bush were not only arguably best friends, but also tennis partners throughout their earlier years growing up together or working together in Houston. So this team knew each other. They trusted each other. And all of them in their own personal memoirs talk about the significance of trust in that. Even though they're friends, you know, Dick Cheney is still running the Pentagon. That's a massive organization. You know, James Baker is running the State Department, a massive organization. And each of those organizations have their own interests and have their own bureaucratic cultures. So when the heads of those organizations, Baker, Cheney, Brent Scowcroft, National Security Advisor, could come together and trust each other to implement what they agreed to do, well, that just made the entire system work. And their system worked incredibly well because everybody below them knew that if their boss had given their word, they better be true to their boss's word.
Now, we're at 90% approval rating after the Gulf War, and then not much more than like 18 months later, he's thrown out of office. Is that kind of a Churchill thing that he, you know, he was needed for wartime but then expunged?
I think actually Churchill's a pretty good analogy there, though I would expand it from wartime in many ways just to times of stress and strife. When Bush comes into office, actually, let me back up, when Bush wins office in 1988, it's clear that the American people are full of anxiety. They're full of anxiety at home. Remember, you know, this is a moment when crime and law and order is a big issue in the campaign. And they're really anxious about what this crazy man in the Soviet Union, Gorbachev, seems to be doing. We should remember that we look back now and see the Cold War as inevitably collapsing by this period. But that's not at all clear. When Bush is running for president in 1988, it's very possible that Gorbachev is simply trying to dupe us, that he's trying some great Machiavellian scheme in order to rebuild the Soviet Union to counter us again, to make Russia great again, if you will. And so consequently, Bush is elected with this incredible foreign policy experience over Mike Dukakis, who has, to all of his credit, has no foreign policy experience. He's purely a domestic governor at that point. And Bush is elected, and then 4 years later, all those anxieties seem to be gone. That is to say, we won the Cold War, we won the Gulf War, the world is going our way, and consequently, the American people are looking for a change.
Listen to Business Talk with Jim Campbell of the Biz Talk Radio Network, 350 stations around the country. Go to biztalkradio.com, find the station closest to you, listen over the Internet, access our podcast. Coming up, we'll talk personal diplomacy.
BizTalk News wants to feature your business as part of our Discovery feature, which highlights businesses that are not yet known nationally, but offer products or services that benefit BizTV viewers. Available in over 40 markets on broadcast TV and online via BizTVClub.com. BizTV wants to help get the word out about your business. If you're interested in having your business featured on a future episode of BizTalk Discovery, email us at discovery@BizTV.com.
National Funding Group has just released $100 million in easy access small business funding to businesses that gross at least $100,000 a year. You can have fast access up to $500,000 in new business capital in as little as 48 hours. Think about the ways you could grow your business if you had up to $500,000 cash infusion. Call a NFG funding expert now. The process is easy. It only takes about 5 minutes. Then our management-owned lending team looks at your application for a fast approval. You can get 100% funded in about 2 days. If you need up to $500,000 in working capital to run your business and you gross at least $100,000 a year, call NFG and apply today. 800-296-1564. 800-296-1564. 800-296-1564. That's 800-296-1564.
Do you have an idea for an invention or new product? Do you think companies would be interested in your idea? Do you want to try to get a patent? Then call InventHelp now. InventHelp keeps your idea confidential and explains every step of the invention process. Join the thousands of people just like you who chose InventHelp to pursue their idea. We are experienced. We are working for you. We are InventHelp. Get started with your idea. Call for free information.
Call 1-800-607-8900. 945. That's 1-800-607-8945.
Due to an upturn in the economy, Main Street Business Loans has pre-approved the release of millions of dollars in small business funding. Your business may already be pre-approved to receive up to $250,000. We've sent out millions of pre-approval letters. We see the economy growing, and our underwriters believe now is the time to invest in your business so you can grow faster and make more money. And we're prepared to give you up to $250,000 to do it. Your funds can be available in 5 days. There are no application fees, no annual fees, just quick access to up to $250,000. If your business did not receive your approval letter to get up to $250,000, call Main Street Business Loans Approval Desk now.
800-430-7570. 800-430-7570. 800-430-7570. That's 800-430-7570.
If you're one of the millions of Americans who can't work because of a serious injury or illness, you may be eligible for disability benefits from Social Security. Receiving benefits is your right. It doesn't matter if you've applied before and the government has said no. Let the experienced attorneys at Bill Gordon and Associates help you get the Social Security disability you deserve. Their team of attorneys have been fighting for benefits for people just like you for over 20 years. And best of all, there's no fee until you receive your benefits. There are many conditions that make you eligible, including some you may not even be aware of. So if you're disabled and unable to work, call Bill Gordon and Associates today for your free no-obligation consultation. See if you qualify for the Social Security benefits you need and deserve. 800-470-4453. 800-470-4453. That's 800-470-4453.
Biz Talk Radio.
Talking with Jeff Engel, the founding director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU. We've got Desert Storm, the fall of the Soviet Union, Tiananmen Square in China, Eastern Europe coming back into independence, USSR. You compared it to FDR, all these kinds of changes. What did he think was the most important thing he accomplished, and what was the biggest screw-up?
What Bush thought was most important is actually really easy to answer. It's the reunification of Germany, which is the single most complex question, arguably, of the entire Cold War. In fact, I would argue that really the reason the Cold War occurs is because the Soviets and the Americans largely can't decide what should happen to Germany after World War II, and everything else spirals out of that. And, of course, when Germany is given the opportunity to reunite, that is, when the Berlin Wall falls, there's basically nobody in Europe who, outside of Germany, who thinks that's a good idea, because people remember that the Germans had not been so great for the continent the last time they had been together. And there was a fear that they would do the same thing in the future, that they would become a dominant power. Every one of the major powers who has a say in this diplomacy is against it, except George H.W. Bush. And his argument was really profound. He argued that we need Germany to be whole and together as a Western power. And in NATO in particular, we need to harness Germany's strength in NATO. But the real reason is because without NATO, why is the United States over in Europe? And, of course, we're seeing today how useful it is with Russian-American relations teetering. Mm-hmm. We're seeing how useful it is a generation later to have American forces have an invitation to be in Europe. So when Bush looks back on his great accomplishments and his most difficult negotiations, reuniting Germany and keeping American power in Europe is number one at the list.
I had, by the way, not known that he really, the other three of the four major powers were pretty much against it at the time, particularly Thatcher. Is there something that he regrets the most, or the biggest screw-up kind of a deal?
That's a really good question. I think he regrets not winning a second term. And I think he regrets, obviously, you know, I think not doing more to stave off humanitarian crises that, frankly,
yes,
there's no great answer to. Yugoslavia begins to...
Somalia,
under his watch, Somalia as well. And also, I think one thing in particular is that Bush tried, through his Hippocratic diplomacy, to always speak quietly and not rile up foreign passions. He'd never wanted to get foreign leaders angry with his words, and he never wanted to get foreign peoples to move because of his words. And he tried very hard not to incite the Kurds and the other ethnic minorities and religious minorities in Iraq to rise up against their government, unprepared to do so. And yet they heard in his words at the end of the Gulf War a desire for them to rise up. And I think Bush regretted that, of course, those uprisings were put down with great violence and force by Saddam Hussein. And I think Bush regretted not finding the right words to match American policy and desires to what he was saying.
Interesting. Now, he was criticized. He himself said he didn't buy this vision thing. He wasn't transformational. But you read your book, you really feel he architected this post-Cold War period very well, which is a vision thing to me.
Yeah, you know, I think he had a vision, and I think he knew that he had a vision, and people around him understood his vision. There was a fundamental problem with his vision from a political standpoint, which is that George Bush's vision was fundamentally Franklin Roosevelt's vision. That is to say, everything that the United States wanted to do at the end of the Cold War under Bush's leadership, that is, put strength into the international system bounded by American power, let markets and democracy flow around the world, let cooperation, again, under American leadership, be the foundation for a new peaceful era. That's what Franklin Roosevelt wanted and why he helped work so hard to create the United Nations in 1944 and 1945. The problem was, from Bush's perspective, that the Cold War got in the way, that the Cold War and antagonisms between the Russians and the Americans kept us from implementing this great idea in 1945. But then, boom, by 1991, the Cold War is gone. So Bush's vision is basically now we get a chance to do what we always wanted to do. The problem politically is that doesn't sound new. That's something that American policymakers have been saying for 40-odd years, and American public has been hearing for 40-odd years. So even though the opportunity is new, the rhetoric is not, and therefore Bush is criticized for having no new ideas when his basic argument was, now we get to implement the really good ideas that we've always had.
Interesting. I'm going to look at some of these big issues now through a personal lens, because that's how I seem to operate. You started off with this pause, this status quo plus with Gorbachev that didn't really make much sense to me. But talk a little bit about Gorbachev and the whole Russia deal.
Yeah, Gorbachev is, I think, is going to be appreciated over history as one of the great transformational revolutionary figures of the 20th century. 20th century doesn't unfold the way it does without him in charge of the Soviet Union. For one fundamental reason. That is to say, everyone in the Soviet bureaucracy understood, I would argue, as early as the mid to late 1970s, that their system wasn't working, that it wasn't producing economically, culturally, politically to keep up with the West. The difference between Gorbachev and the leaders that came before him is that Gorbachev was that really rare leader who didn't only identify a problem, he was willing to do something about it. And he ushered in a great era of transformation in the Soviet Union and therefore in the communist world, instilling new democratic ideas and new market forces, something that was completely antithetical to the Soviet system because he thought that was the only way to save the Soviet Union. What this all comes to a head in the pause, as you asked, that is the first few months of Bush's administration, is that Ronald Reagan embraced Gorbachev by the end of his term, but Bush and those around him, frankly, thought Reagan had gone too far, that Reagan, who used to say, trust but verify, had not, in fact, verified that perestroika and glasnost, Gorbachev's reforms, were real and sincere. So Bush came into office essentially not knowing what he wanted to do with Gorbachev. So therefore, he announced to the world that we're going to have a top-to-bottom policy review of Soviet-American relations, which basically buys him a few months to not only think about what he wants to do, but more importantly, a few more months to gather evidence of what Gorbachev is actually doing. I thought it was actually really a remarkable bureaucratic move.
Now, got a couple minutes left in this segment. Deng Xiaoping in China, and he was an ambassador there, and the Tiananmen Square protests in 1989 really turned them back to authoritarian way, even through till now. Did he feel he did not do enough? What was his thinking?
I think Bush ultimately felt that there was very little that an American president could do at all in that situation to keep violence from erupting. I mean, we have to remember Beijing is not only very far away from the United States, but China is a nuclear power. So it's not as though the United States has the options that it did in Somalia, for example, of sending in troops in order to keep violence from erupting. Once violence erupts at Tiananmen Square, Bush's fundamental argument is that this was clearly a democratic movement, and it was a democratic movement in large part because democracy was emboldened by being exposed to the West. The West was essentially a virus, if you will, within Chinese circles. The idea of freedom is a virus in Chinese circles. So consequently, Bush says after Tiananmen Square, when people on the left and the right are arguing we need to isolate China, cut off relations with China, punish China, Bush says, no, we have to go in the other direction. We need to tell them they did wrong, but make sure they stay engaged. because if the virus of democracy is what brought them to almost the point of change, the last thing you want to do is remove that virus. And therefore, he really thought we need to think about China not in terms of the 1990s at that point, but China in the 21st century and beyond, and in order to keep it engaged in the international system.
Listening to Business Talk with Jim Campbell from our flagship stations, WGCH Greenwich and WYBC Yale Radio. Next segment, This Will Not Stay.
Reason number 12 why you should own a ThermoSpa's hot tub? They require no attachment to your home's plumbing. Thanks to the ThermoSpa's unique built-in thermofiltration system that filters the water an incredible 144 times a day, you simply fill it with a garden hose and your water stays crystal clear with very little maintenance. Call to receive a free DVD and brochure and find out how you can own a ThermoSpa's hot tub for only a few dollars a day. Right now, they're offering 0% APR financing with approved credit and a $1,000 savings coupon, including free delivery, free chemicals, and a cash discount. And with models starting at $4,995, there will never be a better time to own a ThermoSpa's hot tub. So call now and ask about this limited time offer. Call ThermoSpa's today at 800-956-7183 for your free DVD and brochure. That's 800-956-7183. ThermoSpa's, hot tubs designed to improve your life. Call 800-956-7183 today to take advantage of 0% APR financing.
Attention business owners and independent contractors. This is a money-saving message from Tax Mediation Services. If your business owes $20,000 or more in taxes, we can help you today, right now. Listen, dealing with the IRS is no picnic. It's an intimidating and extremely stressful process, and you don't want to go it alone. Our attorneys know every law, every tax break, and every possible opportunity to help you resolve and reduce your tax debt. And if you owe more than $20,000, you may be at the top of their hit list. So don't take your tax debt lightly, because it will not go away on its own. The IRS can seize your bank accounts, your home, and even shut down your business. Call our tax experts today at 1-800-285-4765 and let us deal with the IRS while you focus on your business. That's 1-800-285-4765. Again, 800-285-4765.
Life insurance is one of those things that just about everybody needs, but few people actually have. Hey, if you die unexpectedly without life insurance, guess what? You'll leave your family with even a bigger mess. Life insurance will help replace your family's income. It'll help cover burial expenses. Life insurance can even help pay off debt like credit cards and medical bills. Life insurance can even pay for college. And if you own a business and you die, life insurance can help your business from collapsing. It can even help cover estate taxes. Life insurance has never been more affordable and needed. Plus, you can always shop around even if you have a plan and save some money. So call the Life Insurance Quote Line right now for free pricing information.
800-915-9658. 800-915-9658. 800-915-9658. That's 800-915-9658.
My computer is so slow, it's making me crazy.
I used to have that problem.
Did you quit using a computer, or did you buy a new one?
No, I called Geeks On Site. They made an appointment to visit my home and showed up the same day.
You mean they didn't ask you to bring your computer to a shop? That's what happened when I called a support company.
Geeks On Site can go to your home or business or even repair your computer online. They have 24/7 emergency service.
If you're having problems with your PC or Mac, call Geeks On Site. 1-800-591-1682. Our friendly certified computer repair experts are available 24/7. Call now for a free diagnosis. 1-800-591-1682. Data recovery, virus removal, and maintenance for all laptops, desktops, printers, and networks. That's Geeks On Site for friendly certified computer repair experts, available 24/7 over the phone or in your home or business. Just call 1-800-591-1682. That's 1-800-591-1682. 1-800-591-1682.
Do you have an old car sitting in your driveway? How would you like to learn a hassle-free way to get rid of it
help kids in need, and get a great tax donation in the process. It's real easy. One simple free call to our car donation hotline is all it takes. Call the Neshama Foundation at 800-721-6723, 800-721-6723. We'll come pick your car up for free and give you a tax donation for the full value of the car, running or not. The value of your unwanted car will go to help kids in need. It's fast and easy. Just call us and your car will be gone and on its way to helping children in 48 hours. And you get a nice tax deduction. Call the Neshama Foundation now to get rid of your car, help kids, and get a tax write-off.
Call 800-721-6723, 800-721-6723, 800-721-6723. That's 800-721-6723.
Biz Talk Radio.
We're back with Jeff Engel. He's written When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the End of the Cold War. And now we'll go to the Gulf War, perhaps what he's best known for, and tremendous coalition building and success. But I was surprised at the beginning of it how much initially it was about oil and how tentative they were. Talk about Desert Storm.
This is, I think, the moment in the book I'm most proud of, because we tried for over a decade to get access to some of the key initial records from the Bush administration and finally did. And it really did tell a different story. We now know better. The initial reaction from the Bush administration to Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait in 1990 was essentially to recognize that maybe this isn't such a big deal. That's behind the scenes. That they said, you know, what really matters about Kuwait is oil. That's the only reason anybody really cares about Kuwait is its oil. And Saddam Hussein is desperately poor at the end of the Iran-Iraq war and took over Kuwait because he wants to sell its oil. So if we care about oil, Saddam Hussein is about to make it not only available but cheaper. But this actually might be an economic boom for the United for the rest of the world during a period where the Middle East is really the sole provider for oil throughout the world. So consequently, the initial, by which I mean the first few hours, reaction from American policymakers that maybe we just need to suck it up and let this one ride. It's only after reflection, after a few more hours, and after a few more days, that Bush and those around him come to the realization that, no, what really matters here is not the oil, but the precedent. That is to say, if we allow Saddam Hussein to aggressively gobble up a new country, a neighbor, I should say, during this new period of the end of the Cold War, that's going to send a message to others that that's okay to do, that that is the way the post-Cold War world will function, via force. And that was something that Bush could never countenance.
So, in retrospect, do you think that this thought that Ambassador Glaspie provided, maybe inadvertently, a green light, we don't get involved in border disputes, do you think that did loom large? And also, from what you said before, did Saddam have bigger goals from Kuwait, Saudi Arabia? Was there this sort of caliphate kind of vision or not?
Personally, I we know a lot from Saddam's records now, too, of course. I think he thought of himself less as the leader of a caliphate in the Middle East and more as a secular strongman who would be respected throughout the Middle East. You know, I'm very hesitant to say what his ultimate plans were, because I don't think he knew what his ultimate plans were. But there's no doubt that the initial plan for Hussein was to take Kuwait and then consolidate it into Iraq. He had no designs on Saudi Arabia during the initial conflict. Going back to Ambassador April Glaspie, she, of course, had famously told Saddam Hussein in the days leading up to the invasion that the United States has no opinion on the border dispute between Iraq and Kuwait that was the titular cause of the crisis. She was subsequently ridiculed and, in fact, run out of the Foreign Service eventually. The truth of the matter is what she did was actually both proper diplomatic protocol and language and also in line with her instructions from Washington. That is to say, the United States doesn't take positions on border disputes around the world, largely because there are thousands and thousands of them, and we don't want to be involved in every border dispute. We don't want to arbitrate them. The only thing we care about, and this point she made clear, is that disputes cannot be decided through force and violence. And she was very clear with Saddam Hussein that force and violence was not going to be acceptable, and the United States would respond to that.
Do we have a similar thing that we had in ending the Cold War, which is because it was managed so flawlessly, it doesn't look as big as it was? I mean, I think in the book you make clear that the Middle East, there could have been a huge bloody fallout throughout the Middle East. We could have had an oil recession, as with the Cold War. We could have had civil wars or revolutions. Part of it, the reason he doesn't get the credit right is because it was managed so well.
I think that's exactly right. We really, as historians and as a public, don't focus on the moments where things work well, which are really quite sometimes more impressive and more complex than when things go badly. To take the broadest picture here, when the Soviet Union and European communism collapses, we need to recognize that that's really the end of an empire. And historically, going all the way back as far as we can see, historically, when great empires collapse, great wars ensue. That is to say, the power vacuum that occurs with the empire's collapse is quickly filled by violence and by others who want to essentially take claim over that land, that space, that power. We also never run this experiment before in history with nuclear weapons in the mix. So the fact that we did not get a major war at the end of the Cold War is really a historical anomaly, and we should all be surprised in many ways that we made it out so well. And I argue in the book that one of the reasons, not the sole reason, but one of the reasons we made it out so well was because of Bush's quiet, thoughtful diplomacy behind the scenes, essentially keeping the international system going and keeping international tensions calm during a period of tremendous flux.
It shows you, too, that he kept his ego under control because he wasn't really looking for all of the glamour, et cetera. I looked at the components of success in that war, and if I go through them, we've done almost the opposite in the second Iraq war or other: coalition building, overwhelming force, limited goals, and it was even paid for by, you know, the other partners. How about that?
It is really a model of the way that the American people and the American military in particular thought was the ideal way to fight wars coming out of Vietnam. That is to say, if the central problem in Vietnam from the military's historical perspective was that we did not have popular public support, we didn't have political support, and we didn't have the ability to use all the force at our disposal for some limited aim. That is to say, we had not really identified America's strategic goal in Vietnam in many ways. All those things were present in the Gulf War, as you said. It's a model for how the United States could use its overwhelming force around the world, so long as it didn't try to be too ambitious. I like to say that the difference between the George Bush 41 and the George Bush 43 policies in Iraq come down to a single idea. That is, both of them believed freedom was the future, both of them believed markets were the future, both of them believed the world was going to ultimately turn democratic. Bush 41, the older one, believed that we needed as United States to keep calm and let history unfold in our direction. Bush 43 and those around him believed that we needed to catalyze history, that we could essentially jumpstart the process. They thought this, of course, because they thought after 9/11 they didn't have a lot of time on their hands in the way that others had. But either way, I think that Bush 43's fundamental divergence from his father is not in the ultimate goals that they had, but in the way they thought the United States could actually manifest those goals in their own lifetime.
Interesting. Let's go back now. We're at that 90% I mentioned. There was no domestic desert storm. They thought he was out of touch. Sununu at one point said, "We don't have to do a thing before the election." Do you think that was a mistake? And also, his brand was integrity and character, and Read My Lips ended up looking like a lie.
Exactly right. You know, Bush made the pledge in 1988 that they would not raise taxes. But then an interesting thing happened. You know, he came to the conclusion through the thoughtful study and through the words of his, through looking at the calculations of his own advisors and economists, that really we needed a little bit of a tax hike in order to keep the economy flowing. In fact, I think the entire prosperity that we see in the 1990s is in many ways a direct result of the tax and budget deal that Bush reluctantly signed in 1990, even though it was a break of his campaign pledge, even though he knew this was going to be terrible for him politically, he thought it was the right thing to do for the country. And time again, we see Bush doing that, essentially suffering the wounds of being president, being in the spotlight, being blamed for everything that goes wrong in the country, as every president is, suffering those wounds quietly. because he understood and he believed that he was doing the right thing for the country, and that his personal success and personal popularity was less important than America's success. And it really is something which, frankly, I wish contemporary leaders would think more about.
Let me ask you about his relationships with Newt Gingrich. Newt was sort of like the first insurgent-type politician, which we've gravitated more and more to in gridlock, et cetera. How did that affect President Bush 41?
Well, Newt Gingrich is a person who does not come off well, if you will, in George Bush's political memory. Newt Gingrich is the one who essentially tries to scuttle the budget deal in 1990 because he thinks he really believes we can't have any tax increase, no matter what the economists say. And the story, the background of Gingrich is actually really fascinating here, because Gingrich should not have been doing those negotiations. Those negotiations should have been done by Dick Cheney, a Dick Cheney who is different than the Dick Cheney we remember today.
Yeah.
The Dick Cheney of the 80s and the early 90s was renowned throughout Washington for his ability to be a political compromiser, for his ability to reach across the aisle and cut deals, and he's the kind of person everybody wanted to work with. And he was in line, essentially, to be a leadership of House Republicans until he was surprisingly called to be Secretary of Defense after the Tower nomination fell through, after there was a series of scandals that called the first nominee's credibility into question. Bush and those around him had to scramble to find a replacement, and they settled on Dick Cheney, even though Bush writes in his diary at the time, "I'm nominating Cheney, but I'm worried that means Gingrich is going to take over."
Hmm.
And Gingrich is not a man that I trust and not a man that I believe we can work with in the long term.
We'll talk Bush 41 legacy, final national segment.
If you're 85 or younger, would you like peace of mind and comfort for your family? We're Final Expense Direct with an urgent message for you. The average funeral today costs over $8,000, but the most you'll get from government benefits is $255. How will your family pay the difference? We can help. Our senior plans start as low as just a dollar a day and pay up to $30,000 for a funeral and other final expenses. Peace of mind is easy. There's no medical exam. You'll have lifetime coverage, and your plan can't be canceled as long as you pay your premiums. Call now for free information about our senior plans. Answer a few simple questions and receive approval right on the phone. Plus, call right now and we'll give you a discount prescription card for free. Call 800-569-3414. That's 800-569-3414. Again, 800-569-3414.
Non-attorney paid spokesperson. Could your house go into foreclosure? Are you behind on your mortgage payments? Does it seem like the bank has no interest in helping you save your home? And you feel like you have nowhere to turn for help? Then we have good news for you. Foreclosure Protection Services can help save your home, as they specialize in foreclosure assistance. That's all they do. If you're behind on your mortgage payments, being threatened with foreclosure, have been denied a loan modification, or been the victim of a predatory loan, it's critical that you call Foreclosure Protection Services now at 800-670-2142. Their network of attorneys and their agents are available to speak to you now. If you're behind on your mortgage payments, Foreclosure Protection Services can help stop the foreclosure process. Call today before it's too late. New laws are in effect that may save your home. Call Foreclosure Protection Services now at 800-670-2142. 800-670-2142. That's 800-670-2142.
As a small business owner, there's one word that you absolutely dread: payroll. For small businesses, it's a big burden. You may think you're saving time and money doing it yourself, but come on, are you? Timesheets, processing checks, calculating taxes, a total waste of your time. Paychex simplifies payroll processing, saving you time and money. Submit your payroll online, fax it in, or call your dedicated Paychex payroll specialist, and you're done. Learn more at trypaychex.com. Come on, do the math. The IRS dishes out 8 million penalties a year. Make one mistake and you're on the hook. On average, you're losing nearly one business day every month doing payroll. That's time and money you'll never get back, unless you get Paychex. More than 500,000 small businesses already do. Call 877-649-5324. Trade payroll pressure for peace of mind. Call now, 877-649-5324. That's 877-649-5324.
If you're over the age of 50 and considering buying an annuity in the next 60 days, I have some important news for you. Don't buy an annuity until you understand the pros and cons of annuities. A free book to help you maximize your retirement income from television host and three-time author Josh Melberg has been released. This book reveals little-known truths about annuity strategies in simple-to-understand terms. Grab a pen right now, because we are about to offer you this free book that unlocks the five little-known secrets we believe baby boomers and seniors should know before buying an annuity. Call 800-935-0752 now, and you'll receive a free copy of Josh Melberg's book, Next Gen Annuity Strategies Revealed. As a bonus, we'll also send you a copy of The Number One Mistakes Retirees Are Making with Their Investments Today, and a free DVD on how you can get up to 33% more income in retirement. Call 800-935-0752. That's 800-935-0752. Employees of J.T. Melberg Financial have the appropriate licenses for the products they offer.
I live alone and rarely have visitors. So when I slipped and fell in the kitchen last month and couldn't get to a phone, I knew I was in trouble.
Help!
I could barely move.
Help!
I tried calling for help, but no one could hear me. As I lay there, I couldn't help but think of my kids and grandkids having to go on without me. I was terrified. It took 8 hours for my neighbor to find me. It could have been the end of me. That's when I knew I needed Life Alert. With just one press of this button, I'm connected to the Life Alert Center, where I can get the help I need, even when I cannot reach a phone. With Life Alert, I'm never alone.
Call 1-800-414-1958 for your free Life Alert brochure. That's 1-800-414-1958. 1-800-414-1958. Call for your free Life Alert brochure today at 1-800-414-1958.
Biz Talk Radio.
Our final segment with Jeff Engel, an expert on the presidency of George H.W. Bush and the presidency in general. Before we get to what you think his legacy is, we had this end of the Cold War, looks like a brave new world, as you called it, and a peace dividend was coming and all this. What happened?
Well, you know, I think long-term tectonic changes caught up with us.
Yeah.
That is to say, that the problems that were evident and drove the 2016 election, which I would argue are essentially the problems of deindustrialization, the problems of how to keep all Americans flowing towards the prosperity of a globalized world. We know that globalization is, of course, best for the economy as a whole, but it's not necessarily best for people in Altoona, Pennsylvania. It's not necessarily best for people in Ohio. These problems were all evident in the 1980s, in the 1970s even. And I think by the 1990s, we had incredible prosperity that was generated by globalization, by the policies, the budget policies that Bush put into play in the early 1990s, and of course by this crazy new thing called the Internet that transformed all of American economy and society, but not everybody came along with it. And so I think the peace dividend that Bush and others really hoped for around the world basically never appeared, because we never got enough money flowing through the system, because the system itself needed a retinkering and needed a retooling.
Okay, so we've talked about that he's not really a transformational change agent. He's maybe the last WASP elite, nonpartisan foreign policy type of guy. How do you assess his legacy? Where do you put him as a president?
You know, I put him very, very high, not surprisingly, because I think Bush faced more difficult international problems than any president since Franklin Roosevelt, and solved them quietly and solve them prudently. That's the word that we always associate with Bush, but it's actually the best word.
Yes.
Consequently, the thing that I take from Bush's presidency that I wish subsequent presidents would keep in mind is that if you are the most powerful country, which we are, if you have the most dynamic economy, which I still believe we have, really what you need to do is not constantly remind people of how strong you are, and not constantly put yourself into situations that are only going to be draining on your resources. That is to say, if the stream of history and all of American power is actually moving in the right direction, don't screw that up. Let the fundamentals of the United States govern. And so I think the fact that Bush was able to use American power judiciously, cautiously, prudently, and then overwhelmingly when he needed it. That really is going to be his greatest legacy, that he was a president who understood that the fundamentals of the United States worked and that you essentially shouldn't screw things up is more important than trying to get things exactly right.
Was he too humble, too little of ego, not enough in the limelight? This wimp thing got attached to him. As also intrigued character-wise, he took jobs that were not necessarily, they were out of favor, if anything, the Republican National Committee and the CIA.
Yeah, he takes all the jobs, basically, that nobody else wants. And largely, I think that's because he was so comfortable in who he was. Let's remember, if going back to the beginning, George Bush is a man who was to the manor born. He was an elite. He was well-educated. He was always affluent. He never questioned who he was and never worried about who he was. So he was willing to take jobs nobody else wanted because he knew his reputation as George Bush was always going to be intact. And ultimately, I think that that hurts him politically. So I would like to pause for a second and remind everyone that anybody who wants to be president of the United States must have a distorted ego. Because what you're really saying there is, I, among all the rest of 300 million odd citizens, am qualified to do this job. And more importantly, I should have more power at my disposal than any other person in the world, enough power to destroy the world. You know, if you had a friend who said that to you, you would actually suggest perhaps they needed to seek psychiatric care. that level of hubris. So even though Bush was remarkably modest by presidential standards, let's not kid ourselves. He also really believed in his own power to lead.
Very competitive guy, too.
Oh, remarkably so. The whole family actually is remarkably competitive.
Now, this theme about do not harm, how would he feel right now as I look at stuff? Russia and China relations getting worse. Middle East is the Middle East. Trade wars, tariffs being put on, exiting TPP, putting a wall on the border, North Korea. What would he think right now? I mean, big risks or?
You know, I think it's important to remember that when Donald Trump ran for president and tried to get the Republican nomination, he basically ran against the Republican establishment as much as anything else. And George Bush 41 represented the Republican establishment. I think what Bush was in favor of, Bush is in favor of internationalism. Trump is not. Bush is in favor of free trade. Trump is not. The Bush administration were the people who negotiated NAFTA. Obviously, we know the president's opinion on that today. More importantly, Bush believed in cooperation and that the world and the United States would benefit most when the world does well, not necessarily just the United States, which I think is not Trump's impression. Frankly, I would argue, and I have no problem saying this, that if you set out to design a policy that was more antithetical to Bush's, you could not do a better job than what Trump has done. But I would go a step further to say, if you set out to create a foreign policy that was going to hurt the United States in a long time, you could not do a better job than Donald Trump has done, because all those fundamental beliefs that Bush had about trade, about cooperation, about restraint, those are actually the foundations of American power over time, which are now being steadily eroded by the current administration.
Very interesting. It's sort of, we started with vindication and we end up maybe there, because in the long run, he may look like the prudency may look may get vindicated, all these risks we're taking right now, which, as you said, are exactly the opposite of where he came from. So you think a one-term president has a chance to be ranked as a top-notch president?
Yeah, you know, the presidential rankings are a lot of fun. I mean, a one-term president is never going to make it to the top, obviously, because they got voted out. I think what we need to remember when we rank presidents is to remember that some of them get dealt a better hand than others. Some of them, of course, will be blamed for the economic crises and the political problems that occurred on their watch, whether it's their fault or not, and some will get credit for great times. The reason I think Bush deserves more credit than he receives currently is because he was dealt an incredibly complex hand and played it incredibly well. Again, I come back to the point that I'm astounded that we all survived the end of the Cold War. And it wasn't just because of Bush, but another more belligerent, more argumentative, more bellicose president in the White House at the time would, I think, really have screwed things up. And by screwed things up, I mean started a war that perhaps could have led to a nuclear conflict. I'm really impressed that Bush's restraint is one of the reasons that we're all here to have this conversation today.
I'll tell you, Jeff, you make a better case for him than he makes for himself. Thanks to Jeff Engel. They had book again when the world seemed new. George H.W. Bush, the end of the Cold War. This has been Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Our next show, we've got Andrew Yang. He's a tech CEO. He's going to talk about how automation is killing jobs. He's calling for universal income. He's running for president in 2020. Thanks to Jeffrey Engel. Thanks to our national audience for listening. See everybody next Sunday on Business Talk with Jim Campbell.
The opinions you hear on Biz Talk Radio are those of the hosts, callers, and guests, and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, Biz Talk Radio, its management, or advertisers. The information on Biz Talk Radio does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or securities. Please consult a professional before investing. If you have any questions about Biz Talk Radio, contact us at 817-274-1609 or at biztalkradio.com. Biz Talk Radio.